Back together, you and I, to wrap up a very busy week, Friday, January 21st, 2022, right here on Connecticut Today. We welcome back Associate Professor of Medicine at the University of Connecticut School of Medicine, Dr. David Banik, to chat about the current COVID-19 situation. Yankee Institute for Public Policy reporter Mark Fitch had an update on the latest political stories from Hartford in his monthly check-in. And I also had to have a few thoughts I felt about how criminals in many cities are being allowed back on the streets to reoffend, and in some cases with deadly consequences. And we continue on a Friday edition of Connecticut Today right here on WICC 600 AM, 107.3 FM, and online at WICC600.com. We'll get back to open phones a little bit later on. Going to get the latest update from another well-known expert on COVID. Our next guest is an infectious disease doctor and associate professor of medicine at the UConn School of Medicine. He is the hospital epidemiologist at UConn Health, John Dempsey Hospital, and he serves as medical director for infection prevention. We had him on about 2 years ago now at the beginning of this pandemic to get his early thoughts. We'll see where his thoughts are as we hopefully may be getting near the end of this, cross fingers. Dr. David Banik joins us again. Dr. Banik, hi, it's Paul here at WICC. Thanks for joining us. How are you today?
I'm doing well, thanks. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks, Dr. Banik. I remember when we spoke 2 years ago, you were laying out the fact that early on there were some worries because of the speed at which these cases were popping up in the first places around the world. You said it was concerning, and you sure were right, along with all the other experts on this. Give me a summary here for our listeners, Doctor, and before we get into the boosters and the vaccines and their efficacy, has this played out the way you thought and other experts thought? Were there some curveballs here? How'd the whole scenario play out in your mind?
Sure. So, I think when we look back on what's happened the last couple of years with COVID, I think there were some things that could have been predicted. So once we identified that we had a novel virus that spread very quickly, and, by novel, I mean something that has not been seen before in human populations. I think there was concern that this would spread rapidly worldwide and have a very significant impact on the population. I think, with these waves of infection, I think we've seen the virus evolve. And that also is not surprising for coronaviruses. These viruses mutate, can change over time. And, we see that with our seasonal coronaviruses. So, I think, there's some aspects that seem to be fairly, predictable, the changes, the waves of infection, the infections occurring particularly at high rates in the wintertime. So those kinds of things were expected. I think some things that may have been a bit of a curveball. So when we saw that this most recent Omicron variant had mutated so much that made it very highly transmissible and could cause infections in folks who were previously infected and folks who were vaccinated, I think that was a bit of a surprise to see a variant that had so many mutations, so many changes that it was able to spread so quickly across the population. So that was a bit of a surprise. I think, at least here in the Northeast, we're seeing this most recent Omicron wave begin to descend. So that's encouraging. But I think we have to learn from what we've seen so far over the last couple of years and thinking about the future and how we're going to respond to this virus, which it seems like will be with us, at least in the relatively near term. We're going to need to figure out ways to adapt and live with it.
And a lot of you folks, Doctor, in the infectious disease pursuit of medicine were quite accurate, I thought, early on, saying this would hit particularly hard people 65 and over into their 70s and 80s. And unfortunately, that turned out to be quite true, didn't it?
Yes, it did. And that's been based on what's been seen with other respiratory viruses, including the flu. Other similar viruses that cause infections. These infections tend to disproportionately affect older individuals. I think what's been seen with COVID-19 is that, disproportionate impact is even greater. Older folks, do seem to be the most impacted far more than those of younger age. Fortunately, children in terms of the clinical impact, severity of illness, don't seem to be as impacted. I think this shows that older populations are particularly vulnerable, and we need to give special attention in protecting them.
Dr. David Banik is an infectious disease physician, associate professor of medicine, UConn Health. He's the hospital epidemiologist at the UConn Health John Dempsey Hospital. We'll check in with more on COVID-19 with Dr. Banik after we do traffic and weather together right here on WICC. And we continue here in a Friday edition of Connecticut Today right here on WICC 600 AM, 107.3 FM, and online at WICC600.com. Dr. David Banik for a few more minutes. He's an infectious disease physician, associate professor of medicine at the UConn School of Medicine, and he is the hospital epidemiologist at the UConn Health John Dempsey Hospital and also serves as the medical director there for infection prevention. Dr. Banik, regarding the vaccines that we have been using now for several months here and the boosters, again, is this irregardless of the vaccination levels here, but the actual functioning of the vaccines and the boosters and the percentages associated with that. Are you folks happy with that in your profession? Is this about what you thought the rollout would lead to?
So, you know, I think when we look at the vaccine, we can see it's been a very successful vaccine. And speaking broadly, you know, we have a few different options for vaccination here in the U.S. But the vaccines have been really successful in preventing certainly severe infections and mortality. I think that's played out quite clearly, you know, here in Connecticut, where we have a highly vaccinated population, as well as, you know, across the country. You know, when we start to look at how things have evolved over time, you know, I think it's become clear that at least with our newest variant, the Omicron variant, the boosters are particularly important in preventing the consequences of infection. So, you know, any individual who's eligible for a booster, you know, still, you know, should go out and get that booster dose. And, you know, I think, you know, even boosters notwithstanding, you know, the primary vaccine series is still critical. So, you know, we're doing what we can to help provide access to the vaccines, to help provide education, answer questions that people have about the vaccine, because they really do seem to be the most important way to prevent the consequences of this infection. So, you know, I think a lot of questions come up about the future with vaccines. You know, I think we'll be able to improve the vaccines, adapt them to circulating variants that are coming out, hopefully in the coming months. And, you know, I think that'll make them even more effective in preventing infection and the consequences of infection.
One thing, doctor, that you probably deal with maybe in getting direct questions from your patients, and I deal with it here on the show sometimes from callers, is people see that vaccinated people do still contract some strain of COVID. And again, and I'm sure you have to tell people to bring this up to you, vaccines, no matter how effective they are, they're not perfect, are they?
Yeah, I think that's an important point. You know, these vaccines, you know, are extremely protective against against infection. You know, I think, you know, they were never intended to prevent all infections. You know, I think, you know, what we see is, you know, people develop infection, inhale virus in their nose, they get, you know, the upper respiratory infections, and then those antibodies from the vaccine are able to prevent any progression of the infection. And that's really important, you know, to sort of separate the impact of this infection from a cold to a severe respiratory infection impacting the lungs and leading to hospitalization and downstream consequences. So, you know, I think the vaccines are performing very well. You know, those individuals who do develop infections and are vaccinated really tend to have mild infections and recover quickly. And that's really important, you know, in transitioning this virus from kind of a devastating, life-threatening infection to a milder infection that's similar to other common upper respiratory infections that we see seasonally. So, you know, the vaccines really are critical in that regard. And, you know, I think really support that even though, you know, we are seeing folks develop infection, the mildness of those infections in vaccinated people is a sign that the vaccines are working and they're really doing their job.
And finally, doctor, the progression of and the potential now for these pill form antivirals. I know one or two have been approved. They do take quite a long time to produce and develop and transport properly. So it'll be a while before they're available in a mass scale. But what are your thoughts on moving forward here beyond vaccinations with the antivirals?
So I definitely think this, the antiviral therapies are going to have a role. They already have a role, you know, here at UConn and centers throughout the state. You know, we have been prescribing them, and we have relatively limited quantities, and we're using them in our highest risk individuals, particularly those with immunocompromising conditions who may not be able to respond well to a vaccination and are at highest risk. So, you know, I do think that these therapies are going to continue and hopefully become increasingly available to the public. You know, I think once the production scales up, you know, the hope is to transition these oral medications from sort of hospital-based usage and settings to retail pharmacies where they'll become more accessible to the public. And there are going to be additional oral antivirals that will become available, newer drugs that are similar to the currently available therapies. So, you know, I'm optimistic about these. I think they will continue to have a role in helping treat individuals with COVID infection and preventing the consequences like hospitalization from occurring.
Dr. David Banik is an associate professor of medicine at the UConn School of Medicine. He's also the hospital epidemiologist at the UConn Health John Dempsey Hospital. Dr. Banik, good to chat with you again. Take care, and hopefully we can check in down the road. Thank you, sir.
Thank you again for having me on.
Our monthly check-in with this gentleman, he is a correspondent, writer, opinion leader at the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. Check him out at yankeeinstitute.org. He issues his Fitch Files column and keeps us up to date here and all over the state. Does a great job with the folks at the Yankee Institute about some of the stories in Hartford that might not be, you know, to go back to my old newspaper days, above the fold, but are important because they usually involve taxes and taxpayers. And we begin with a couple of those. Mark Fitch is with us. Hello, Mark. Happy New Year. How are you?
Hello, Paul. Happy New Year to you. I'm doing pretty good. Just hanging with my goldfish, waiting for the week to end. So.
Nice. How's the goldfish doing? Is the goldfish prognosticating on the election yet or not coming up?
Oh, well, I mean, they have about as, you know, solid a thought on it as anybody else, I would say.
Right. Okay, let's start with a couple of things. I'll read, folks, this is a paragraph here from some of the Yankee Institute reporting. The union representing professors and faculty at UConn says state lawmakers should reject tax cuts and instead fund state employee raises, according to a message posted on the union's Facebook page. Mark, I'm no expert here, but this might be traipsing a little into the tone-deaf category. I'm not sure, but what do you make of this?
Well, I mean, this is part of the ongoing negotiations. I mean, this is happening, you know, across the state with every union, you know, state employee union that we have. You know, they're negotiating with the Lamont administration, or in this case, they're negotiating with, you know, UConn to, you know, secure their next 3-year or 4-year contract. And part of that is wage negotiations. So they're apparently not too happy with UConn's offer of a 2.75% raise over 3 years. And instead, the professors are asking for a 5% raise off the bat, retroactive to August 2021. And then they want the subsequent years, they want their raise tied to inflation, which we all know has been, you know, very high lately. Mm-hmm. At 7%. So, yeah, that could, you know, this is part of the negotiation tactics. You know, get your people riled up, get them calling their lawmakers, get them, you know, getting out to the media, things like that. So, but, you know, with those kind of, you know, you're talking, if you had your wages tied to inflation, I mean, the 7% bump would be quite a bit. And
must be nice.
with UConn, I mean, they had a, you know, budgetary wise, they had a tough year last year. You know, they were $50 million in the red, you know, when they lost, you know, all this money because of COVID.
Yeah.
And now we know that their athletics department's not doing so good. And now they have to fork up $11 million to their former basketball coach, Kevin Ali, who I will note is part of this very same union.
Mm.
So now they got to fork over $11 million for that. So, you know, how much money they'll have left over for raises, I guess we'll see. But, you know, it's one of those things where it's, you know, there are talks of tax cuts going on because Connecticut's revenues have been doing surprisingly well throughout the pandemic, largely because of, you know, Wall Street earnings. So they're saying, hey, you've got the money, you know, instead of doing tax cuts, let's do some raises for state employees. And I doubt I have to remind you, they just got raises. So they just got, you know, the second half of an 11% raise in 2020, I believe.
Yeah.
Right at the height of the pandemic.
You know, Mark and Mark Fitch is the guest before we break here from the Yankee Institute. You talk about the Kevin Ollie situation and UConn in general, the athletic department again, and the whole, you know, $40-something million. Part of that is COVID. We get it. But, you know, Mark, I always ask legislators and people I know and support staff at the Capitol, I used to ask them, does anybody ever raise an eyebrow or really make any substantive objection to what UConn does with its money? And I was told in no uncertain terms, on and off the record, well, no. And if you do, it's like you get, as my Italian people say, Mark, you get the malocchio, you get the evil eye up there. And a lot of legislators and people up there, I mean, they went to UConn. So it's almost like this golden urn that you kind of don't touch. Like, you get angry a little bit, but UConn gets usually what it wants.
Yeah, I'd say that that's probably the case. I mean, they do argue, you know, every now and then that their funding has been reduced over the years. But, you know, it's Connecticut's flagship university. Politicians want to be seen as supporting this, you know, this great public, you know, education center that we have. So, yeah, when they come to the legislature asking for things, they generally get a warm reception. I mean, just last year they were asking for the state to cover more of their pension payments, you know, because they have to, it's a big cost driver for them, as they have to, pay the pension, you know, the pension debt for their professors, and it actually decreases their ability to get research grants. So they were asking for help in paying that. They were asking for bonding help for, you know, new buildings, things like that. So, and for hiring more, getting more research grants. So they go back to the Capitol, hands out, and, you know, lawmakers are generally very receptive to it. I mean, it is a major Connecticut institution. So, you know, people can take that, you know, the way they want, but, you know, one thing to note is, you know, tuition never goes down. So, I mean, no matter how much money they get from the state, you know, no matter how much money they might bring in, it seems like, you know, tuition's always going up. So who's really benefiting here? It's not the students.
Well, that's what a lot of folks would say. Mark, hang on. We'll go over some more stuff here. Fascinating stuff, including blackouts, evictions, and all that. Mark Fitch is the guest from the Yankee Institute. First, traffic and weather together right here on WICC. Mark Fitch with us for a while longer from the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. Check him out online, yankeeinstitute.org. The Yankee Institute watching some interesting stories here that are kind of there, bubbling up, but don't really grab a lot of the headlines, but they are nonetheless important to taxpayers. Mark, what's all this I've heard and read and heard from guests, too, about the possibilities of electric blackouts in the state? What's up with that?
Yeah, so ISO New England, which, you know, pretty much runs the energy generation and grid for all of New England, sent out a warning back in December saying that the region is in danger of rolling blackouts if we get a long cold snap. And, you know, this obviously, you know, affects Eversource and United Illuminating, and, you know, Eversource sent out, you know, messages to all municipal leaders saying, you know, this is a possibility, you should be prepared. And so what the real problem is that we moved away from coal and oil because they're, you know, polluting and things like that. And we moved to use most of our energy generation for New England is natural gas, and which is, you know, doesn't pollute nearly as badly. And, you know, we have pipelines coming across New York into New England to, you know, bring in this natural gas, this liquefied natural gas. But the problem is, while that's our biggest source of electricity generation, we never expanded the pipelines to bring in more natural gas. So when you get these extended cold snaps in the winter, a lot of that natural gas goes to heating people's homes instead of electricity generation. So what they have to do is start burning oil to make up the difference. Mm. And there's only so much oil in reserve. So we could end up in a situation where there's just not enough electricity being generated. And at that point, it would fall on Eversource to determine, how they're going to roll these blackouts, across what sections and affecting what customers.
Wow.
In order to control this situation.
During a cold snap.
Yeah. And, some of the municipal leaders in Northwest Connecticut that I interviewed, they were very concerned about this because, they heard lengths of time of like 8 to 10 hours. Oh. Well, if it's 5 degrees outside,
Jeez.
8 to 10 hours. I mean, I can tell you, I'm not going to be doing very well. I have electric heat in my apartment, so
yeah.
It's going to be rough on me. But if you start thinking about, people with disabilities or, seniors who may not have generators, backups and things like that, well, then the town has to figure out, how do I keep these people safe? And how do I keep them safe during COVID? We can bring them all into the town hall where we have, backup generators and stuff. But now, are we creating a super spreader event?
Unreal.
So it's a possibility. They say it's a low probability event, but
mm-hmm.
it's something they've been forecasting for years. In 2018, ISO New England put out a study saying that this is a potential problem in these years. So
wow.
they were forecasting for 2024, 2025.
Mm.
But obviously, it's starting to come around a little earlier than they expected.
All right, Mark, hang on. We'll get back to you for one more segment here, because when we come back, we'll talk about a prior agreement with state unions and Governor Daniel Malloy that still has a, remember him? Way up in Maine now. Still has a little hole in it. More with Mark Fitch. Coming up, first, traffic and weather together, Wall Street, and more right here on WICC. And it's our monthly check-in with our buddy, our pal Mark Fitch, writes the Fitch Files columns and more at the Yankee Institute for Public Policy in the state, yankeeinstitute.org. And finally, Mark, on this edition, I remember when now former Governor Daniel Malloy had struck a deal with CBAC, and there was a projection of some projected savings, other savings that would be found, and according to the figures you and the Institute have looked at, that hasn't happened.
Well, yeah, the latest report that just came out about the savings from the 2017 CBAC agreement found it was about $200 million short, which is about 10% of their projected savings. And what's kind of interesting is, this report is put out by the Comptroller's Office, and it lists every provision and what the projected savings are and what the actual savings are. And what I found most interesting is that, by and large, the largest savings provision has been the switch to Medicare Advantage as the administrator for retired state employees for their health care. And this was put forward by Comptroller Kevin Lembo. And what's really interesting about this is it shouldn't have been part of the contract negotiations. It was merely an administrative change that, saves us hundreds of millions of dollars a year. But now that it's part of the CBAC contract, it'll always be part of a union bargaining issue. So it's not like the state, if they find a better deal somewhere down the line, won't just be able to switch. They'll have to go back to the negotiating table. But that's been the biggest savings by far. And the rest of them really haven't lived up to the hype. So the Medicare Advantage has done so well in saving so much money that, all the other provisions of the contract that actually didn't save nearly as much get made up for. But they still came up about $200 million short of where they thought they'd be.
Interesting. Mark, as always, great stuff, folks. It's Mark Fitch again, and you can check out his stuff at yankeeinstitute.org. Once again, check it out, yankeeinstitute.org. Mark, thank you. We appreciate it. Have a great weekend. We'll check back next month. Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much, Paul.
All right, there you go. During that newscast, you may have heard about a vigil, some sort of a gathering in New York City, mourning the death of 61-year-old Yao Pan Ma. Unfortunately, the gentleman was attacked, kicked in the head back in late April, back on April 23rd. He finally passed away a few days ago. And you have what was categorized there by that newscast as a vigil, and a gathering, because folks want to crack down on anti-Asian hate, which is fine. Nobody should ever be attacked, be subject to physical intimidation, being wounded, sometimes killed, unfortunately, wounded fatally, because of their ethnicity, their nationality, where they come from. I think all logical people can easily agree on that. But here's the thing that a lot of outlets never tell you, including, look, and I have a journalism degree, so I consider myself a now former reporter. But when I did it, I think I did it well. And I put in the facts I thought that had to be in the story. And more oftentimes than not, and you can not believe me if you'd like to, I always say that, look it up. Go online. You can find this stuff. There is this notion, especially by some in my business, always looking for the, always looking for the social justice angle and everything. Well, this is anti-Asian hate, and look at all these people getting beaten up. Or anti-whatever hate, anti-Jewish, anti-Asian, anti-black, whatever, all these people getting beaten up in cities. What they never tell you is, I'm sorry, I shouldn't say never. Never is a big word. Never is too much of an all-encompassing word. I shouldn't do that. I should have an automatic shock collar put on me, and Eric can press a button and, you know, give me a little shock. Don't do that, Paul. I'll give Eric the remote, and I'll bring in my son's dog's old shock collar. No, but seriously, I shouldn't paint with a broad brush. But, having said that, you do know that most of the time these people are attacked in New York, this gentleman, for example, that was tragically killed, this 61-year-old Yao Pan Ma, by all reports here in the New York media, nice guy, very quiet guy, elderly gentleman, was collecting cans, they say, when he was kicked in the head repeatedly and eventually died. This woman, this 40-year-old Asian woman who was, I think, last weekend pushed in front of an oncoming subway in New York. The vast majority of these incidents, well, while the media might portray them as anti-Asian, anti-this, anti-that, because of who dies, they rarely tell you who does this stuff. And I had an inkling because I remembered this story, listening to it at the top of the hour, going, I think this guy was killed by a nutcase. And he was. Much the way some 60-year-old nut, and I'm sorry if you think that's, but come on, let's call it for what it is. Because it took the cops about 5 minutes to find this guy last week that shoved this poor woman to her death in front of the subway train to the 42nd Street Station in Times Square. Oh, he was known to police. Why? Because he's been threatening, as he's been a nut, and he's been a crazy for years there, who shouldn't have been on the street. Now, I know what you're saying. Well, just because people have mental difficulties, because they're crazy, that means we can't just pull them off the street. Well, if they're a threat, we can't. So we're supposed to just allow them to go and wreak havoc, as they do. Look where the vast majority, not just in New York, but in Philly, L.A., Boston, California, places like that. And we sit here and we go, well, he's homeless and he has mental difficulties. Get him off the street. See, nobody has the guts to do that. Nobody in modern America has the guts to the gulliones, the cuervos, los castanetes. They don't have the agates, as my father used to say, to do this. Now, the guy who apparently attacked and essentially killed this gentleman is surprised. He's an ex-convict. Who would have thought? I was thinking Mensa member. I was thinking member of a chess team somewhere. No, he's an ex-convict. He was repeatedly kicked in the head on April 23rd, and an ex-con, Jared Powell, was caught on video assaulting him. So you say, well, okay, what does that mean? Well, Powell says here, if you scroll down here, Powell has had at least, 15 prior arrests dating back to 1988. He claimed, of course, the victim attacked him first. Yeah, sure, pal. So you, because you're a nutcase, you go ahead and do this. Now, what should we do? You know what we should do? We need to incarcerate more people, which I know is verboten. You can't say that today. Because if I say that, I'm evil. I'm anti-black, I'm anti-Hispanic, I'm anti-Asian, I'm anti-whatever. Fill in the blank. It's Friday. I don't care. But you read all the time, not just in New York, but even here in Bridgeport and areas around Connecticut. Well, so-and-so, comma, who has had 12 prior arrests. There was a guy in New York the other day who got arrested. And the he had 31 priors. At what point does a modern society who tries to stay away from being a third world country, at a third world banana republic dictatorship, at what point are people allowed to say enough? I know there are people who, after one arrest, they turn their life around. That's great. I know there are people who have been in and out of jail several times and they finally get it turned around. That's great. But at what point, especially, and you folks I know in Fairfield County, you pay attention to this, you go into the city every day, you have friends and relatives that live 50, 60 miles away in the city, you know, in all stretches of New York, you watch this stuff. At what point, as a society, as a functioning, normal, safe society, do we say, okay, this guy's been arrested 8, 9, 10 times. He has to be inside for 5 or 6 or 7 years. See, there's been this, I would say, questionable move. Now, I'm not a criminologist, but you hear all the time, empty the jails, fewer people in jails. Okay, that's fine. If you have workable solutions to make sure they don't reoffend, all good on you for that. But what about these people that you and I read about every single day in the paper here, locally, nationally, in New York, where the police say, oh, by the way, we've arrested this guy 17 times previously or 23 times previously, and they're let back out. What level of lunacy is this? Well, Paul, we don't have enough jail space. Well, build more. What are we doing here?